House Democrats have been suggesting that their impeachment investigation could take just a matter of weeks, not months. But the White House is drawing battle lines as tensions between the executive and legislative branches are really increasing.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is one of the people leading this resistance. He's trying to delay five current and former officials from handing over documents and testifying in the impeachment inquiry.
And let's bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Morning, David.
So why this resistance from Pompeo? Why is he not letting these officials come in and testify right now?
Well, he wrote this letter to the House Foreign Affairs Committee saying that these individuals needed more time to prepare and get proper legal counsel. And he claimed that Democrats were trying to, quote, intimidate and bully these career officials, and he wouldn't have it. That's really, though, the kind of language that's used to try and win a message war. And Democrats interpreted it as an attempt to simply delay for President Trump. I mean, Democrats fired back at Pompeo. They said, in fact, he was the one potentially trying to intimidate witnesses and that, quote, any attempt to prevent them from talking with Congress is illegal and will constitute evidence of obstruction of the impeachment inquiry. The timeline as we know it now is today the State Department Inspector General is expected to brief congressional staff about some of their document requests on the Ukraine matter. Democrats are going to depose behind closed doors Kurt Volker, a former envoy to Ukraine, tomorrow. And they rescheduled a deposition with Marie Yovanovitch, who was the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. That was supposed to happen today. Instead, it's going to happen next week, October 11th, as a result of this letter.
But what about these officials who Pompeo is trying to hold up? What did lawmakers want specifically to know from them?
Well, I mean, Democrats are seeking closed-door testimony as part of the impeachment inquiry. With Yovanovitch, the way some of the things that Democrats are looking into, they want to know why she was removed from her post, what led up to it. You know, the whistleblower complaint notes that she'd been a critic of a Ukrainian prosecutor, his poor record on fighting corruption. And the whistleblower notes that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, is on record saying that she was, quote, removed because she was part of the efforts against the president. In wanting to talk to Volker, it looks like it also centers around Giuliani. Volker resigned from a voluntary post at the State Department. And the whistleblower says that Volker was one of the officials who spoke with Giuliani in what the whistleblower calls an attempt to, quote, contain the damage to U.S. national security. So Giuliani was trying to circumvent usual national security decision-making processes. And the complaint also says that Volker spoke with Ukrainian officials. He was trying to smooth out sort of and reconcile the differing messages that were coming from Giuliani and through official U.S. channels. So the point here is for Democrats to kind of try to fill in the blanks, connect the dots, and figure out what's really going on.
Domenico, is all this making its way onto the campaign trail?
I mean, it's overshadowed everything on the campaign. The primary battle's really taken a back seat, and the candidates are saying they support impeachment inquiry or even the impeachment of the president overall. And we're, you know, they're trying to make some news, trickling out some of their fundraising numbers, but really impeachment has been the principal thing.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Does Harvard discriminate against Asian Americans in its admission process? A federal judge has now ruled no.
This case was one of the most serious legal challenges to affirmative action in years. The plaintiff is a group called Students for Fair Admissions. Now, they argue that Harvard holds Asian American applicants to a higher standard in the admissions process. Judge Allison Burroughs, who presided over the case, said Harvard's admissions process is, quote, not perfect, but she also said it's not unconstitutional.
Of course, this decision is not likely to end this fight. It could keep going on. Carrie Young reports for NPR member station WBUR in Boston and has been following this case. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
So can you sort of summarize this ruling for us? What did the judge here say?
Yeah, well, the ruling was very detailed. It came in at around 130 pages yesterday. But what a lot of it boils down to is that she says Harvard's admissions office did not intentionally discriminate against Asian American applicants. So she dispelled any notions that the school might use a racial balancing system, which is kind of like a quota, and that's not legal under federal law. And she decided that Harvard did prove its case in court through personal testimony and also a lot of statistics that race is not a deciding factor, and it's not weighed too heavily. And as you mentioned, Judge Burroughs did note that Harvard's admission system is not perfect. In fact, she suggested the school consider implicit bias training. But she concluded by calling it a quote, fine system that she doesn't want to dismantle, especially because she says it serves a compelling interest, and that's maintaining diversity at one of the country's most selective schools. Hmm.
So, I mean, as I mentioned, this might not be the end of this legal battle, but how are the two sides responding to this decision so far?
Well, in a statement, Harvard is calling the ruling a victory for students, diversity, and the rule of law, they say. Other groups who have been heavily involved with the case, on Harvard's side at least, are also celebrating this decision. I spoke last night with Rachel Kleinman. She's with the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, which joined Harvard as a friend of the court last year. They represented student and alumni groups, and she says she's thrilled about this ruling because a case like this can make other schools rethink or at least reaffirm their affirmative action policies.
I think this is such a clear signal that they can continue to be doing this important work, to be admitting diverse classes. And so I think this is a real victory for colleges and universities and the students who attend them across the country.
Now, for the plaintiffs, Students for Fair Admissions, they say they're very disappointed by this ruling, and they are planning to appeal and even prepared to take this case to the Supreme Court if necessary. In their statement, they said they felt like the data and the evidence they presented in court made a compelling argument.
And so if this does go to the Supreme Court, Carrie, what are some of the implications this could have on affirmative action more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, Edward Bloom, who's the president of Students for Fair Admissions, he's a well-known opponent of affirmative action, and his goal here is to end the consideration of race in admissions. Colleges and universities are worried if that becomes the case, that classes would be a lot less diverse across the country.
Carrie Young reports for member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks so much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
So it's been a month now since Hurricane Dorian devastated so much of the Bahamas.
Yeah, you might remember that this was a very slow-moving Category 5 storm. A couple of days after it hit land, our colleague Jason Beaubien made it to the island of Great Abaco to report on the destruction there.
Just walking around one neighborhood here this morning, we saw four bodies just out in the open. And in addition, there's really a smell in the air. Sometimes you're not seeing the bodies, but you're coming through rubble, and there's a very distinct smell of rotting human flesh.
All right, it was terrible then, and 4 weeks later, the situation there is still desperate, especially in the town of Marsh Harbor. That's the commercial hub of the Abaco Islands.
And Jason Beaubien has returned to see what life looks like now on the islands. And Jason, I remember that vivid description from just shortly after the hurricane. What are you seeing and hearing now that you've gone back?
Look, so the bodies have been cleaned up, but this is still absolutely a disaster zone. There's, you know, debris everywhere still. The roads have been cleared, and you are getting bulldozers coming in and clearing like some of the shanty towns, and some of the schools are getting cleaned up. But, you know, there are areas that are just completely empty, just eerily empty, just like looks like a tornado had come through, and there's just foundations and hardly anyone around. So it's still got a long way to go.
With that much destruction, how do you even prioritize? Like, what do you do first when it comes to trying to rebuild?
So right now it's just about sort of relief and rubble. Basically, there needs to be systems so that people can come here, work here, and deal with this next phase. So there's systems being put in place to just make sure people have some place to eat, trying to get people basic places to sleep under. And then this next big thing right now is dealing with all of this rubble, getting it out of the way. I talked to this guy, Sylvan McIntyre. He's actually from Grenada, and he's been running the Emergency Operations Center here in Abaco.
The removal of debris is critical. It's something that helps the psyche of people. It helps you feel that there's a sense of greater hope and there's a sense of things happening.
And they're working on trying to do that. They're working on lining up a huge area as a dump south of Marsh Harbor. And he says that they've signed some contracts and trying to get trucking companies to come in. And they're working on that process and trying to get that going to get this huge rubble removal operation moving.
Just facing all this, it's amazing to hear him say, you know, a sense of greater hope. Are you feeling that? Are there signs of hope, or that things are somehow getting a little better?
You know, definitely there are signs of hope. There's also a lot of sort of uncertainty for people still. But, you know, there is better access to water. There's still no electricity. Every store was destroyed, from grocery stores to marine stores. And that fact that there's no grocery stores is a huge problem. There's basically no restaurants. So people have to get food from somewhere. And one of the amazing things here is that Jose Andres's charity outfit, World Central Kitchen, has set up this massive operation to offer sandwiches and hot meals to anybody on the island. This is Sam Block. He's with World Central Kitchen.
It can make you feel like a human again. That's why for us, doing it on time and regularly is really important, so that, you know, there is some stability and some normalcy in an otherwise very chaotic situation.
And he says that can just come from just having a hot meal every day.
You think residents are going to stay and try to get back to some sort of normalcy at some point?
I think they're going to try to, but it is going to be a long haul.
It's NPR's Jason Beaubien, who has returned to a report in the Bahamas in the wake of that hurricane a month ago. Thanks so much, Jason.
You're welcome.